Chapter 11. His strained gaze in his days of dreaming, so many years ago. They winked their yellow eyes at him dubiously, and as if, though they had been awaiting him all these years in disappointment at his tarrying, they did not much want him now. He was a species of Dick Whittington whose spirit was touched to finer issues than a mere material gain. He went along the outlying streets with the cautious tread of an explorer. He saw nothing of the real city in the suburbs on this side. His first want being a lodging, he scrutinized carefully such localities as seemed to offer on inexpensive terms the modest type of accommodation he demanded, and after inquiry took a room in a suburb nicknamed Ersheba, though he did not know this at the time. Here he installed himself, and having had some tea sallied forth. It was a windy, whispering, moonless night. To guide himself he opened under a lamp a map he had brought. The breeze ruffled and fluttered it, but he could see enough to decide on the direction he should take to reach the heart of the place. After many turnings he came up to the first ancient medieval pile that he had encountered. It was a college, as he could see by the gateway. He entered it, walked round, and penetrated to dark corners which no lamplight reached. Close to this college was another, and a little further on another, and then he began to be encircled as it were with the breath and sentiment of the venerable city. When he passed objects out of harmony with its general expression he allowed his eyes to slip over them, as if he did not see them. A bell began clanging, and he listened till 101 strokes had sounded. He must have made a mistake, he thought. It was meant for 100. When the gates were shut, and he could no longer get into the quadrangles, he rambled under the walls and doorways, feeling with his fingers the contours of their moldings and carving. The minutes passed, fewer and fewer people were visible, and still he serpentined among the shadows, for had he not imagined these scenes through 10 bygone years, and what mattered a night's rest for once? High against the black sky the flash of a lamp would show crocketed pinnacles and indented battlements. Down obscure alleys, apparently never trodden now by the foot of man, and whose very existence seemed to be forgotten, there would jut into the path porticos, oriels, doorways of enriched and florid middle-aged design, their extinct air being accentuated by the rottenness of the stones. It seemed impossible that modern thought could house itself in such decrepit and superseded chambers. Knowing not a human being here, Jude began to be impressed with the isolation of his own personality, as with a self-specter, the sensation being that of one who walked, but could not make himself seen or heard. He drew his breath pensively, and, seeming thus almost his own ghost, gave his thoughts to the other ghostly presences with which the nooks were haunted. During the interval of preparation for this venture, since his wife and furniture's uncompromising disappearance into space, he had read, and learned almost all that could be read, and learned by one in his position, of the worthies who had spent their youth within these reverend walls, and whose souls had haunted them in their mature age. Some of them, by the accidents of his reading, loomed out in his fancy disproportionately large by comparison with the rest. The brushings of the wind against the angles, buttresses, and door jams were as the passing of these only other inhabitants. The tappings of each ivy leaf on its neighbor were as the mutterings of their mournful souls, the shadows as their thin shapes in nervous movement, making him comrades in his solitude. In the gloom it was as if he ran against them without feeling their bodily frames. The streets were now deserted, but on account of these things he could not go in. There were poets abroad, of early date and of late, from the friend and eulogist of Shakespeare down to him who has recently passed into silence, and that musical one of the tribe who is still among us. Speculative philosophers drew along, not always with wrinkled foreheads and hoary hair as in framed portraits, but pink-faced, slim, and active as a youth. Modern divines sheeted in their surplices, among whom the most real to Jude Folly, were the founders of the religious school called Tractarian, The well-known three, the enthusiast, the poet, and the formularist, the echoes of whose teachings had influenced him even in his obscure home. A start of aversion appeared in his fancy, to move them at sight of those other sons of the place, the form in the full-bottomed wig, statesman rake, reasoner and skeptic, the smoothly shaven historian so ironically civil to Christianity, with others of the same incredulous temper, who knew each quad as well as the faithful, and took equal freedom in haunting its cloisters. He regarded the statesmen in their various types, men of firmer movement and less dreamy air, the scholar, the speaker, the plotter, the man whose mind grew with his growth in years, and the man whose mind contracted with the same. The scientists and philologists followed on in his mind sight in an odd impossible combination, men of meditative faces, strained foreheads, and weak-eyed as bats with constant research. Then official characters such men as governor-generals and lord-lieutenants, in whom he took little interest, chief justices and lord-chancellors, silent thin-lipped figures of whom he knew barely the names. A keener regard attached to the prelates, by reason of his own former hopes. Of them he had an ample band, some men of heart, others rather men of head. He who apologized for the church in Latin, the saintly author of the evening hymn, and near them the great itinerant preacher, hymn writer, and zealot, shadowed like Jude by his matrimonial difficulties. Jude found himself speaking out loud, holding conversations with them as it were, like an actor in a melodrama who apostrophizes the audience on the other side of the footlights, till he suddenly ceased with a start at his absurdity. Perhaps those incoherent words of the wanderer were heard within the walls by some student or thinker over his lamp, and he may have raised his head, and wondered what voice it was, and what it beckoned. Jude now perceived that, so far as solid flesh went, he had the whole aged city to himself with the exception of a belated townsman here and there, and that he seemed to be catching a cold. A voice reached him out of the shade, a real and local voice. "You've been a-settin' a long time on that plinth stone, young man. What med you be up to?" It came from a policeman who had been observing Jude without the latter observing him. Jude went home and to bed, after reading up a little about these men, and their several messages to the world from a book or two, that he had brought with him concerning the sons of the university. As he drew towards sleep various memorable words of theirs, that he had just been conning seemed spoken by them in muttering utterances, some audible, some unintelligible to him. One of the specters, who afterwards mourned Christminster as the home of lost causes, though Jude did not remember this, was now apostrophizing her thus: "Beautiful city, so venerable, so lovely, so unravaged by the fierce intellectual life of our century, so serene. Her ineffable charm keeps ever calling us to the true goal of all of us, to the ideal, to perfection." Another voice was that of the corn law convert, whose phantom he had just seen in the quadrangle with a great bell. Jude thought his soul might have been shaping the historic words of his master's speech. "Sir, I may be wrong, but my impression is that my duty towards a country threatened with famine requires that which has been the ordinary remedy under all similar circumstances should be resorted to now, namely, that there should be free access to the food of man from whatever quarter it may come. Deprive me of office tomorrow, you can never deprive me of the consciousness that I have exercised the powers committed to me from no corrupt or interested motives, from no desire to gratify ambition, for no personal gain." Then the sly author of the immortal chapter on Christianity: "How shall we excuse the supine inattention of the pagan and philosophic world to those evidences, miracles, which were presented by omnipotence? The sages of Greece and Rome turned aside from the awful spectacle, and appeared unconscious of any alterations in the moral or physical government of the world. Then the shade of the poet, the last of the optimists. How the world is made for each of us. And each of the many helps to recruit the life of the race by a general plan. Then one of the three enthusiasts he had seen just now, the author of the Apologia. My argument was that absolute certitude as to the truths of natural theology was the result of an assemblage of concurring and converging probabilities. That probabilities which did not reach to logical certainty might create a mental certitude. The second of them, no polemic, murmured quieter things. Why should we faint and fear to live alone, since all alone, so heaven has willed, we die? He likewise heard some phrases spoken by the phantom with the short face, the genial spectator. When I look upon the tombs of the great, every motion of envy dies in me. When I read the epitaphs of the beautiful, every inordinate desire goes out. When I meet with the grief of parents upon a tombstone, my heart melts with compassion. When I see the tombs of the parents themselves, I consider the vanity of grieving for those whom we must quickly follow. And lastly, a gentle-voiced prelate spoke, during whose meek, familiar rhyme, endeared to him from earliest childhood, Jude fell asleep. Teach me to live, that I may dread the grave as little as my bed. Teach me to die. He did not wake till morning. The ghostly past seemed to have gone, and everything spoke of today. He started up in bed, thinking he had overslept himself, and then said, By Jove, I had quite forgotten my sweet-faced cousin, and that she's here all the time. And my old schoolmaster too. His words about his schoolmaster had, perhaps, less zest in them than his words concerning his cousin. 2. Necessary meditations on the actual, including the mean bread and cheese question, dissipated the phantasmal for a while, and compelled Jude to smother high thinkings under immediate needs. He had to get up, and seek for work, manual work, the only kind deemed by many of its professors, to be work at all. Passing out into the streets on this errand, he found that the colleges had treacherously changed their sympathetic countenances. Some were pompous. Some had put on the look of family vaults above ground. Something barbaric loomed in the masonries of all. The spirits of the great men had disappeared. The numberless architectural pages around him he read, naturally, less as an artist critic of their forms than as an artisan and comrade of the dead handicraftsman whose muscles had actually executed those forms. He examined the moldings, stroked them as one who knew their beginning, said they were difficult or easy in the working, had taken little or much time, were trying to the arm, or convenient to the tool. What at night had been perfect and ideal was by day the more or less defective real. Cruelties, insults, had, he perceived, been inflicted on the H directions. The condition of several moved him as he would have been moved by maimed sentient beings. They were wounded, broken, sloughing off their outer shape in the deadly struggle against ears, weather, and man. The rottenness of these historical documents reminded him that he was not, after all, hastening on to begin the morning practically as he had intended. He had come to work, and to live by work, and the morning had nearly gone. It was, in one sense, encouraging to think that in a place of crumbling stones there must be plenty for one of his trade to do in the business of renovation. He asked his way to the workyard of the stonemason whose name had been given him at Alfredston, and soon heard the familiar sound of the rubbers and chisels. The yard was a little center of regeneration. Here, with keen edges and smooth curves, were forms in the exact likeness of those he had seen abraded, and time-eaten on the walls. These were the ideas in modern prose which the lichened colleges presented in old poetry. Even some of those antiques might have been called prose when they were new. They had done nothing but wait, and had become poetical. How easy to the smallest building! How impossible to most men. He asked for the foreman, and looked round among the new traceries, mullions, transoms, shafts, pinnacles, and battlements standing on the bankers half-worked, or waiting to be removed. They were marked by precision, mathematical straightness, smoothness, exactitude. There in the old walls were the broken lines of the original idea. Jagged curves, the stain of precision, irregularity, disarray. For a moment there fell on Jude a true illumination, that here in the stone yard was a center of effort as worthy as that dignified by the name of scholarly study within the noblest of the colleges. But he lost it under stress of his old idea. He would accept any employment which might be offered him on the strength of his late employer's recommendation, but he would accept it as a provisional thing only. This was his form of the modern vice of unrest. Moreover, he perceived that at best only copying, patching, and imitating went on here, which he fancied to be owing to some temporary and local cause. He did not at that time see that medievalism was as dead as a fern leaf in a lump of coal, that other developments were shaping in the world around him, in which Gothic architecture and its associations had no place. The deadly animosity of contemporary logic and vision towards so much of what he held in reverence was not yet revealed to him. Having failed to obtain work here as yet, he went away, and thought again of his cousin, whose presence somewhere at hand he seemed to feel in wavelets of interest, if not of emotion. How he wished he had that pretty portrait of her! At last he wrote to his aunt to send it. She did so, with a request, however, that he was not to bring disturbance into the family by going to see the girl or her relations. Jude, a ridiculously affectionate fellow, promised nothing, put the photograph on the mantelpiece, kissed it he did not know why and felt more at home. She seemed to look down and preside over his tea. It was cheering, the one thing uniting him to the emotions of the living city. There remained the schoolmaster, probably now a reverend parson. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.